I want to talk about the Spice Girls. I want to talk about the Spice Girls.
I was just speaking to Jerry before I arrived here.
Do you think Margaret Thatcher had girl power?
Yes, of course.
Do you think she effectively utilized girl power by funneling money to illegal paramilitary death squads in Northern Ireland?
I don't know about that.
Thanks for joining us on the Angry Scotland podcast.
We're on an express elevator to hell going down.
We're on express elevator to hell going down.
Suiting up like fucking Doom Guy here. The subject matter of this episode is
Margaret Thatcher.
Yo, she bitch. Let's go.
I remember coming home from school one day and my dad was home. And this was weird. And my dad had his head in his hands and my dad was crying. And this was weird. And it's the first time as a child that I had ever seen what I would categorise as despair. Because my dad had been made unemployed alongside millions of other people in the economic turmoil that she was causing with her policies. And there was no particular hope in sight for him of there being another job to go to. And he had me and my mum to support and a mortgage to pay and all of these things. And he was absolutely beside himself with fear and worry and despair about his situation. And so I will never forgive her for that. And when she resigned, I was happy. And when she died, I wasn't happy. I'm never happy when anybody dies. But you can just feel that you can then underline that chapter, that that's done and that's finished and that it's gone. And you can be not happy, but you can be satisfied that a thing has ended. And that's how I felt. Her callousness was responsible for that kind of despair in the hearts and minds of people all up and down England and Wales and Scotland and Ireland. And she was no longer a presence, and I was not sorry.
So she comes to power in 1979.
Yeah.
Do you think then there was an understanding of how economically cruel she was going to be to the poorest in society?
I don't think there was an understanding of that in 1979. I think perhaps there was an understanding that she was going to be economically strict, but I don't think there was any general understanding of the kind of economics she represented. Was she seen as a sort of necessary evil? I think for a lot of people she was, because it had been chaos under the Labour Party for much of the 70s. Although, to be fair, it had been chaos with Ted Heath in the early 70s. So, you know, the situation of what was going on worldwide in the 70s was that it was pretty much fucking chaos everywhere. I think there was an understanding that she was going to be economically strict, and she had previous as a minister, Thatcher the Milk Snatcher, but the extent to which she would be cruel was perhaps not understood. She wasn't interested in taking care of people. She was interested in this ruthless everyman for himself ownership society.
I don't know that much about Thatcher, but I think in a lot of things in politics, I've noticed that you tend to get these exaggerations from both sides. Usually distort the truth a wee bit. Our conservative fans who think she's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and you know, they've got pictures of Thatcher up on the wall like they would have with the Queen. Almost a religious figure, saintly, Mother Teresa type person. So you get that side of it, and then you get folk who just think she's the devil incarnate and just the worst thing ever. And I think for both sides, they benefit from portraying that kind of a character, like a pantomime villain or pantomime hero. I find it quite hard, actually, to find out what the truth was about that individual. It seemed like a lot of people, actually, in history, when you go back, everyone either was to say they were amazing or terrible. If you try and read books about any of these people from history, even recent history like Thatcher, it's just hagiographies, just crap, basically. It's so hard to wade through all that stuff to see what actually went on.
Certainly within the ranks of the boarding school classes that tended to make up the front bench of the Conservative Party, probably still does, there is a lack of warm relationships with women because they are sent away to boarding school. So even if they have sisters, they're not in the same house as them most of the time. They're obviously not got a normal warm relationship with their mother because they're not in the presence of their own mother all the time. I mean, this is Sparta stuff. You take the kids away and you rear them in these fucking dreadful circumstances. And it's a way of effectively producing people who are a little bit sociopathic because they just haven't had their empathy strengthened by normal human relationships. They de-fetishize her. They sort of turn her into a kind of handbag-toting Boudicca. But she wasn't that. She was just a very, very self-interested, cold, callous person who destroyed vast amounts of the social fabric of the UK to try and remake it into something that actually nobody's asked for.
I read a wee bit of John Sargent's book. He said she would get in close with these guys that had no warm female attention throughout their childhood. So this older lady snuggled up to them and put her hand on their arm in a soft voice telling them what she wanted them to do. I can see how, like, in the halls of power that might have been slightly effective.
I would go with Margaret Thatcher.
Why the hell Margaret Thatcher?
Oh, so nobody here thinks power is sexy. Not one of you finds power sexy.
Thatcher was a woman who got ahead by colluding with the patriarchy.
Well, I actually think she put back women in politics for some period of time because there was certainly probably a sense of, like, we've let a woman have a go and fuck me, look at that. Do you know what I mean? It did not help anybody. You know, we didn't have another female prime minister until Theresa May snuck in by accident after Brexit. She was not a feminist. I don't think the fact that she was a woman was something that occurred to her. And it didn't occur to her that she should help other women. She certainly didn't have any number of women in her cabinet. She didn't encourage other women to stand. It wasn't something that she cared about. And I'm not sure to what extent she even thought about the fact that she herself was a woman and whether or not she should do anything for other women. I don't think she ever thought about that she should do anything for other people of any gender. I just don't think that would have occurred to her at all.
I do think there's an interesting irony in the fact that Nicola Sturgeon credits Margaret Thatcher as her motivation for getting into politics. So you're in a situation where arguably the cruelest and worst woman in the history of British politics inspires arguably one of the best women in British politics.
And of course, it's coming from a point of view of not I want to be like her. It's like, I want to be the fucking opposite of her and what she stands for. You know, I mean, things have changed socially between Thatcher and Sturgeon and everything like that. But to see Sturgeon or Lorna Slater or whoever else getting into going, I can do this. I should tell I can do it better than a lot of the men out there and whatnot. It seems almost the antithesis of Thatcher, who was just, well, Thatcher.
Just on this point, it might be worth bringing up Priti Patel in terms of pulling the ladder up on other individuals. Do you see her as almost a continuation of that mentality that Thatcher had?
Do you know what? I'm going to say something in defence of Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher was not stupid. Priti Patel is thick as fucking mince.
I think a lot of these current Tories hark back to that period. It's almost role-playing as a sort of Thatcher character.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's Thatcher cosplay.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, we don't see that happening elsewhere. In Scotland, we've got Nicola Sturgeon, we've got Lorna Slater with the Greens, Leanne Wood was down in Wales. They don't have this vibe, but it seems in England that that's almost how they define strong women.
It is interesting, as you say, the characters that have ended up being politically successful have had a certain element of domination about them, certainly in English politics. where you end up with the Thatcher cosplay is Brexit. And that's ironic because actually the common market was something that Margaret Thatcher was, as a laissez-faire economist, she was interested in the idea that capital should be able to move freely. And we've ended up making it impossible for capital and goods to move freely with Brexit because it's fucking stupid and it's an absolute fucking nightmare. But what she was interested in was using crisis in order to bring change. And that's what Brexit has been used for. And so fucking bring that full circle. That's what that is. And the whole up yours Delors nonsense is, I suppose, the natural endpoint of that.
I expect she had a very authoritative upbringing. Her father, Alfred Roberts, strikes me as somebody that would have had very rigid and fixed views about right and wrong. And probably when she was growing up, those rights and wrongs were not up for debate. And I think that she has either inherited or has been taught to enforce those rights and wrongs sternly, aggressively, and without mercy.
I believe she was from a Methodist family.
Converted to Anglicism later, but yeah, very, very tub-thumping Wesleyan.
Yeah, that's a kind of moralistic bunch. Avoiding alcohol and things like that would probably be common there.
I would be surprised if she actually had any sincere and devout religious beliefs. I think she, rather like Theresa May, is one of those people who is too inflexible personally to move outside of her upbringing. But I don't think she had Jesus in her soul, shall we say.
I wonder if at the time when she was elected, you know, in the early on in her political career, maybe she was more in line with what the country was like. I think it was 1980 only that homosexuality became legal in Scotland. When she was elected in 79, she was in line roughly with a small C conservative attitude across the country, but she remains very dogmatic to that as the country evolved and matured away from that. So that towards the end of her political career, it's hard to imagine how anyone ever voted for her by that point.
Why is her homophobia alone not enough to confine her to history? Because as recently as a few years ago, we had Joe Swinson, idiot former leader of the Liberal Democrats, advocating to have a statue of Thatcher made. The individual that spearheaded Section 28. It's very confusing to me, given how times have changed and how much progress has been made, that somebody that has the beliefs that Thatcher held could still be held with respect by people that have in recent times run for office. I mean, Ruth Davidson and the tank photo that she did, which was a direct reference to Margaret Thatcher. Do you think it goes through a Ruth Davidson's head that there is an inherent contradiction in her being a lesbian, doing effectively a photo shoot referenced to somebody that pushed for Section 28?
Well, firstly, I would say that I don't actually imagine that gay rights are something that most of them give a fuck about. Despite the fact that there may actually be quite a large gay contingent, or they may have friends, family members, or whatever, because they don't think in that way. Identity politics isn't for everybody, and so the idea that because you are black or Asian or gay or whatever, that you should therefore automatically be on the left is a notion that the left has that the right doesn't share. And to be honest with you, it is lazy stereotyping. The assumption that just because somebody is gay that they will automatically be left-wing is not correct. Yeah, they might be gay, but they don't give a fuck about other gay people. The assumption that you care about your own group is a projection. So because you are somebody that cares, you assume that other people will care about their own group. Some people don't give a fuck about anybody other than themselves.
I don't want to speak for Ruth Davidson, but I would imagine Tories like her would say that Thatcher was a product of her time, and that probably if you measured her against a lot of other people at the time, probably have had similar views in terms of, you know, social conservatism. And a lot of these people probably had, you know, mums or grannies or whatever who they loved very much and they knew they were very good people, but did have bigoted views. Probably we have people that we know as well. You know, we don't hate them or think they're horrible, but they've got this thing that they've not been educated enough about, and they've not experienced, you know, they've not known any openly gay people or, you know, trans people, whatever. So they're bigoted through lack of education and knowledge, not through just being a complete bastard or whatever. That's probably not the case for Thatcher, but I think that's probably what they would say in relation to that kind of criticism of them still supporting her.
I'm actually really quite cynical as to the extent of the genuine social conservatism of Thatcher. I think she found these things useful tools in much the same way that I think the vast majority of American Republicans who are staunchly anti this and anti gay and anti trans and things like that. I actually don't think most of them give a fuck. I think they just find it a useful rallying cry for steering idiots.
Yeah. I mean, getting back to Thatcher though, I think she was a big fan or a big admirer of Mary Whitehouse and whatnot and the whole Christian conservative society type thing. That just bring it back to religion and all that and the place that plays, and you know, I don't know what the churches teach or taught about sexuality. It was probably wrong, whatever they taught. Amazing how many people actually looked up to Mary Whitehouse or thought well of her in her heyday. I mean, she was trying to get anything remotely sexual or violent off TV and everything like that. I guess she doesn't look well in history, but Thatcher looks better somehow. I don't get it personally.
No, I think people just rewrite the history. People are continually doing this. They just revise the history. The argument now that, you know, she was in favour of closing coal mines because of climate change.
I've seen folks say that unironically. It's amazing.
Arguably, the destruction of the British coal industry has actually led to our per capita emissions at this point, 40 years later, being significantly lower than they are in, for instance, America. I mean, I think our per capita emissions are one third of what they are in America. And that probably is as a result of the fact that we haven't had a domestic coal industry for the best part of 40 years to any great extent. But that wasn't why she did it. She was actually just interested in smashing the unions because they were a challenge to her power.
And we didn't stop using coal. We just imported it instead. I guess also you could say Tony Blair is an environmentalist from the point of view that he killed a million people in the Middle East.
Think of all that carbon dioxide they're not breathing out.
What I do see is the government's role in that kind of scenario is to offer retraining programs of some kind for the workers and the staff that are a part of that dying industry. And that's what I feel did not fucking happen here with the mines and Thatcher.
Well, this is where the Friedmanism comes into play. She was a proponent of Milton Friedman's extreme economic policies. The idea behind laissez-faire economics is that light-touch capitalism produces the best results for everybody. The ideas that Milton Friedman put forward was that there should be really no regulation from the government of business at all, for the most part, and that the market will take care of everything. Now, in the fullness of time, the market will take care of many things, but what it doesn't do is take care of everything immediately. And so the idea of what Naomi Klein refers to as shock therapy economics is that the problems of the 70s, for instance, had been caused by too much intervention by governments in markets, and that therefore you needed to stop it all rapidly and suddenly, and that there would be chaos. But in that moment of chaos and change, you could lay down a new order and that everything would be brilliant. The only problem is every time they tried it, it didn't work. And the result was always poverty, starvation, riots. And so the only way to actually implement it was usually with an authoritarian regime.
One of the comments on here is from Maybot 8000. I often wonder how much of what she did would have happened anyway, just more slowly under less demented prime ministers in the 80s. And I think it's quite easy to exaggerate the extent to which what she did was super duper extreme. I mean, it has been in some ways, but at that time, it was probably in line with what was happening in a lot of other places as well. You got to remember the extent to which so many industries were under the state in the 70s. They were making cars, you know, boom, Jaguar, you know, they were making steel, coal, gas, you know, state industries. And over the course of the last 30 or 40 years, pretty much the entire world has changed from a similar system like that. Even in countries that are very authoritarian, like Russia and China, to be more liberal places where these businesses are running in a more free market orientated way. That has been successful everywhere, pretty much.
I would argue that it has not been successful, and water is a good one. I mean, Christ almighty, imagine if you were down south and having to put up with the fucking shit show that is water provision in England. We forget because it just works up here, but that's because it's still state-owned up here. There are certain things that the state should own. There are certain things that it probably has no place owning. I don't really think there's any particular place for the state making cars, for instance. But the infrastructure of the roads, the infrastructure of the rail, the water, the utilities, there's a really good argument that they should own those.
There's not many. I think that the extent to which that has happened globally from what it was in the 70s, it shows that what she has done is not totally out of proportion with what happened in pretty much every other democracy. I mean, even in Scandinavia, places where you say, oh, that's a social democracy, most of these places, that has happened as well. Women weren't allowed to open bank accounts in their own name in the 70s. Your access to mortgages and things like that were much curtailed compared to what they are now. Like, I opened an account the other day and it took me about 20 minutes to open a bank account. You can do that. You can open your own business. You can run things and do things a lot more freely than you were. And that is part of the free market enterprise stuff. I think where I would say that this not being successful has been in the way it's been done. You know, obviously there might be exclusions, you know, roads and things like that, and water. You might find things that are just very difficult to do outside of the state. But the way it was done by the Tories throughout the 80s and 90s was they basically oligopolized things rather than privatized them. The same way as it happened in Russia, where they had businesses where maybe they were on the board or all their pals were big shareholders of these businesses. So they said, right, we'll let trains go into the private market. So we'll give it to these three businesses who will run it for us. And that's not really a free market system. That's just choosing your buddies to run things for you. Essentially, their state is still in control. The worst of both worlds. Plus, the other great thing about having something in private hands is they take the risk as well. So if they don't do a good job, they invest badly, they go out of business, you know, the shareholders lose out. But that doesn't happen in any of these industries, you know, because the government thinks it's too dangerous to let them fail, so we'll just bail them out. So that advantage you would tend to have in private systems is just not there at all.
One of the things that I think is really worth analysing is this ongoing friendship she had with Pinochet from Chile, the dictator who was responsible for torture and murders. Proper old-fashioned picking people up in the middle of the night, bundling them into cars. There was a big sports stadium that was literally just used to house torture of anybody that was considered a socialist. And she was besties with him for years. And the relationship with Pinochet comes back to this relationship with Milton Friedman and Chicago School Economics. And she was being advised by economists from the Chicago School of Economics who were trying to push her to literally just privatize everything and have radical social reform. So removal of all welfare, get rid of the NHS, all the kind of thing that we sort of associate with the worst Farage, Rees-Moggy end now. The beginning of that was Thatcher, and where that came from was Milton Friedman. And so she'd been watching what had happened with Pinochet in Chile, and her economic advisor was trying to encourage her to do more. And I'd like to read you. This is from The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein. The British Prime Minister was well acquainted with what she called the remarkable success of the Chilean economy, describing it as a striking example of economic reform from which we can learn many lessons. Yet despite her admiration for Pinochet, when Hayek first suggested that she emulate his shock therapy policies, Thatcher was far from convinced. In February 1982, the Prime Minister bluntly explained the problem in a private letter to her intellectual guru. I am sure you will agree that, in Britain with our democratic institutions and the need for a high degree of consent, some of the measures adopted in Chile are quite unacceptable. Our reform must be in line with our traditions and our constitution, and at times the process may seem painfully slow. She was being advised to do things that were only possible in Chile down the barrel of a gun. And she was coming up to a general election and knew that she couldn't. And the only thing that made a difference to that was subsequently with the Falklands War, she had all of a sudden this nationalistic Union Jack underpants Ferrari behind her, which then led her to winning the next election when she had been looking like she was going to lose it. and subsequently led to her having the power then with that kind of jingoism behind her to do all of those things. And that's what led to us basically privatizing so many state industries and selling off the family jewels, as it were, as a nation to private enterprise. And this is where I guess Scotland comes into it. That was only possible because by selling off those things, when you sell your assets, you deprive yourselves of the value of them and of the income from them forever, for a one-time hit of what you sell them for. That was only made possible by the revenue from Scottish oil.
The Falklands War is quite an interesting one, because if I have this right, and I may have it wrong, my understanding is that prior to Argentina invading the Falklands, Margaret Thatcher actually cut the naval defence budget. So originally there were naval ships patrolling the Falklands, and following that cut, they were removed, which she approved. She allowed that, and that is what the Argentinians took advantage of to go in, and they did it at a time right before the Falklands winter. The winter in the Falklands is fucking bonkers. It's snowing sideways level shit. And the Argentinians had hoped that the horrendous weather conditions would have prevented the British Navy, British military, being able to get down there to mount a comeback against them. But I just think it's very interesting that you could argue that Margaret Thatcher very much set the scene with that cut to the naval budget.
Yes, she considered the Falkland Islands to basically be just an irritating financial burden. There's a quote actually in here, I'll find it. One of Thatcher's biographers characterised her Falklands policy as practically an invitation to Argentina, to invade. She had cut the defence of it, and so when they wandered in there, I think they thought that we weren't going to bother putting up a fight. I think they had thought, basically, that we weren't bothered anymore and there wouldn't be too much of a thing about it. But instead, we got the full Union Jacks on the front of the sun response instead. And she rode that wave of popular jingoism right through the next election.
It's also maybe worth zoning in here on some of the more controversial acts during the war. The first major combat event was the sinking of the General Belgrano, the Argentinian ship, which Thatcher ordered the sinking of. She ordered one of our subs.
They basically shot someone in the back.
Yeah, so my understanding is that it was returning to port and our submarine shot it as it was sailing away.
Yeah, there's not that much ambiguity. That was a war crime.
So in isolation, that's pretty terrible. But in the wider context of the war, the Argentinians retaliate by sinking the HMS Sheffield.
Yeah.
But it was in direct retaliation for the sinking of the Belgrano. As in, if Thatcher hadn't ordered that sinking, the Sheffield might still be afloat. And indeed, many more people might still be alive.
Mm-hmm.
There's blood on your hands, Mrs. Thatcher!
And this is very much in contrast to the narrative that she was a great leader during this, da-da-da-da. But when you actually read into the history of it, it seems very much like her poor decision-making leads to needless escalation and needless death.
You gotta wonder if any other politicians of the time would have dealt with it much differently. Certainly don't imagine that many of the Tories would have been a great deal different.
One thing that's worth noting is that Dennis Thatcher was an oil guy, and he understood that those waters around there were probably of value. And that's something that doesn't get talked about very much, but I think there's arguably quite a lot of oil in the territorial waters around the Falklands, which is probably why Argentina and the UK have been arguing about an otherwise desolate fucking place for so many years. It is just off the coast of Argentina. It is arguably their territory, and it's gone backwards and forwards, is my understanding. It wasn't okay to leave it, but it wasn't okay to leave it unguarded either in the first place. It was poor policy that led to the invasion being seen as feasible, and then the handling of it was hyper-aggressive, and that was purely for a domestic audience.
And you would suggest if this war had not happened, Margaret Thatcher would have been out.
She was down to 25% approval. She'd run on the famous Saatchi and Saatchi thing of Labour isn't working, you know, with the Dole queue advert. And after a couple of years in power, unemployment and inflation had both doubled. And so it was desperate, and it was not seen that what she was doing was working at all. And by this point, people had got the measure of her personality, and she was really, really unpopular. And then the Falklands thing happened, whether you call it a conflict or a war or whatever we're fucking calling it, but the Falklands happened. The newspapers read, white, and blue the fuck out of it. That same fucking Brexit shit that we see, that empire crap, and all of a sudden she was fucking Britannia herself. She was an absolutely dangerous radical, probably genuinely believed that this great economic boom would come from liberalising the British economy. The problem was that it doesn't happen instantaneously. What actually happens is that you blight millions of lives. The structure of the country was such that, you know, around a coal mine, for instance, would probably be a village or small town where some massive percentage of the working age men would be working in that coal mine. When you close that coal mine, if you don't provide something else and some training for those people, all you do is produce an underclass that don't work for a generation. And because of the really rather extreme nature of their idea that, you know, the market will take care of everything, we can close these mines and the market will take care of things, but the market doesn't take care of things instantaneously. The problem with communism is human beings. The problem with laissez-faire capitalism is human beings. Stuff doesn't happen fast enough, and in between times what you get is a blighted generation of poverty and alcoholism and all of the domestic abuse and poor health that comes as a result of people having no money and no hope and no prospects.
I think that Thatcher is such an economic fucking nightmare on so many levels. So there we just worked through an example of the damage that someone like her could do to one mining town. But then you put her philosophies into the wider context of the global economy with what she did in terms of deregulating the banks, and what that means further down the timeline when we get to 2008. I don't know how big this conversation's going to get. I don't know if someone's going to bring up the gold standard.
I actually know more about the American law on this than I know about UK legislation on it, but certainly in America, after the financial crash in the 1920s and the subsequent depression in the 1930s, there was a piece of legislation brought in America, which was called the Glass-Steagall Act. What the Glass-Steagall Act did was separate retail banking from the casino of the stock exchange. And what it meant was that retail banks had to have a Chinese wall between them and anybody that was being invested in the stock market. And from Reagan onwards, they were removing that regulation. And the more they removed that regulation, the more possible it was for banks to be over-leveraged. I think something that people don't really understand is that when a bank writes a mortgage, they haven't actually got that money in a safe somewhere. A bank is allowed to give you a mortgage. When they do so, they effectively invent that money. And they get to make interest, and the interest that they charge you is their profit, and they make that on imaginary money. This is why it annoys the life out of me when I hear people talking about, oh, you know, the magic money tree and things like this. The entire planet runs on a magic money tree. Money isn't real anymore. Money is just a mental construct that we've all agreed to believe in.
I do just want to back up slightly on that, because I brought up the gold standard half-jokingly, but we should clarify what all this means for some younger listeners that might not be aware of how things used to work. So back in the day, a £10 note actually equated to £10 worth of gold. It represented a physical resource, and most importantly of all, a finite resource, because there's only so much gold on the planet. And at some point along the way, we thought, fuck it, we're not going to bother with that anymore. We're just going to use our imaginations. And this is where everything that Tucker was just talking about comes in. There are now as many magic money trees as you want. It's all just made up numbers. It doesn't actually mean anything at all.
And when we talk about deregulation, it's even worse than that. There's regulations which are specifically designed to advantage certain institutions and people. So it's not just that we've got rid of stuff. They've actually put things in place that are specifically designed to fuck the small guy.
To make it worse.
And advantage people who have already got a lot of money. I'm putting on my Guy Fawkes mask right now.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
An ordinary dinner party. The sort of occasion we all enjoy. The men are exchanging witty stories. And look at the women. Aren't they pretty? Look at the way they laugh. They're delightful. But now the conversation turns to more serious matters.
I wonder if the government should return to the gold standard.
I think it should.
Good. Then we're all agreed.
But oh dear, what's this? One of the women is about to embarrass us all.
I think the government should stay off the gold standard so that the pound can reach a level that will keep our exports competitive.
The lady has foolishly attempted to join the conversation with a wild and dangerous opinion of her own. What half-baked drivel. See how the men look at her with utter contempt.
Damn, they were going home.
Women, know your limits.
We didn't have the Glass-Steagall Act, but I'm sure we had the equivalent. And Reagan and Thatcher were very much on the same page here about, you know, capital should be allowed to do whatever it wants. And the result of that was the 2008 crash, because what capital decided it really, really wanted to do was wrap dog shit in cat shit and sell it to people as AAA packages and mortgages. I think people haven't actually understood how bad it is, because we bailed out the banks with more imaginary money. And so it hasn't bit as hard as it might have done, but by the same token, we've just stretched this imaginary bubble even further. And I really, really worry that there's actually some kind of society-ending problem. There could be weaknesses in the structure of our entire capital society that we've not seen yet.
I do appreciate that this is an absolutely enormous topic, and indeed I think it is one that we'll come back to at a later episode, but to stick thematically with Thatcher for the time being, one thing we have not yet brought up is the Cold War, which was obviously in full swing at the time she was in power. The term the Iron Lady was given to her by the Russians. It was meant as an insult, not a compliment. I don't know if many modern Tories actually know that. So what are your memories of living with Thatcher in the Cold War, the threat of nuclear Armageddon hanging over your head?
Well, that was obviously terrifying, because had the moment come, she would undoubtedly have nuked people. Which is interesting, because I found myself thinking about Boris Johnson. I think Boris Johnson wouldn't nuke people. He's far too much of a ditherer, don't you think?
He would only do it by mistake.
Sit on the button or something. Trying to quote something in Greek and accidentally gives the nuclear codes.
I mean, to be fair, back then, Ronald Reagan's brain wasn't in great shape. Was it Bush or Reagan?
Reagan won the 1980 election, and so he was in power from January 1981 for 8 years, followed by Bush Senior.
So you've got two fairly hard-line Republican right-wingers in there at the same time Thatcher is in office in the UK. As I start to say there, I appreciate that Ronald Reagan's brain was maybe not firing on all cylinders by that point. I seem to call him calling Princess Diana Princess David and things like this. But certainly Bush Senior was a fairly nasty piece of work.
My memory is of being a teenage girl, absolutely paranoid that I would get blown up by a nuclear bomb before I ever got a shag. That is my abiding memory of the 80s, is of thinking that I'm gonna get blown up by these fucking lunatics, and I won't have even been, like, I won't have even got laid. That was my abiding thought. In all honesty, it probably obsessed me from about the age of 14 through to the age of 17 when I finally got laid. There was this sense that they were lunatics. By the time the Berlin Wall started to come down, there had been so much turmoil through the 80s. We'd had economic devastation, miners' strikes, riots, gay rights being a huge thing because of the ban on discussing gaydom, full stop. And so it had just been one thing after another, after another, after another. There'd been Chernobyl. There was this sense that at any moment we were on the precipice of society fucking ending. And it's bad enough being a teenager without having all that shit going on, you know?
So another question from the listeners. This one's from Phil Jonas. Of all the things Thatcher did wrong, by far the worst was the poll tax.
It wasn't actually called the poll tax, although that was effectively what it was seen as being. It was called the community charge. If you can imagine having to pay council tax for every single person in your house. So instead of the council tax being for the house, every single person had to pay a community charge. And the only way around it, generally speaking, was to not be on the electoral register and not be known to be at the address, which is why it came to be known as the poll tax. The idea being that people would just try and stay off the electoral register and therefore not have to pay it. But the downside to that is, of course, you're disenfranchising people from voting. You also had the situation whereby in Labour constituencies, they often had much higher community charges because there would be higher spending councils. The Conservative councils are often more rural, less built up, smaller numbers of people, less services to provide, lower community charges per person. A terraced house in the Midlands with four or five people living in it might be paying £600 or £700 a month, whereas one old lady living by herself in a giant mansion down south might be paying £90. And they decided to test it in Scotland first. So they brought it in Scotland, I believe a year before they rolled it out in the rest of the UK.
Yeah, that was 1989 then. I think the rest of it was 1990.
Yeah.
This one's from David Lockhart, who says, Thatcher was a classic evil basket case who, unlike her successors, really understood that evil begins at home. It's all very well sheltering South African dictators and executing unarmed terror suspects, but what's the point unless you can crush the hopes and dreams of the working class too? Do you think the use of the word evil to describe her is justified?
Yeah, I think she was callous. I don't believe in evil. Evil is an outdated description. She was callous. She did not give a fuck about people. She had an agenda that she thought was right, and she did not care what the effect was on individual human beings. She did not care.
Would you say that was true of the Tory party before her? Or did she change the Tory party?
She changed the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party was paternalistic. It was beholden to sort of aristocracy and the ruling classes, as it were. It was the party of business, whereas Labour was obviously the party of the workforce. But it wasn't cruel. You know, Fries, quite right, is nice and easy to open a business and things like that in the UK these days. That's not a bad thing. But by the same token, it's probably too easy. She was interested in there being almost no regulations at all on business, and that's not healthy. Business can only operate well and fairly when it's got a decent amount of regulation. Not too much, but not too little.
So it's very possible that before Thatcher's time, some of the actions that we saw from her, and indeed subsequent iterations of the Tory party, these actions would have been viewed as morally repugnant, but she's the beginning of change. So now into the contemporary era of David Cameron and Boris Johnson and some of these cruel policies that have been introduced, the justification would be, well, that's what Thatcher would have done. The normalisation of nastiness, the normalisation of cruelty.
For a certain kind of conservative, certainly it was. I mean, when Enoch Powell made the Rivers of Blood speech, Heath apparently spoke to Margaret Thatcher about the fact that he was planning on sacking him. And Thatcher advised against it because she thought, you know, although the language had been a bit intemperate, she thought he was basically right. She was anti-immigration. She was anti-gay. She was actually much more poisonous than Theresa May. Theresa May didn't have the intellect of Margaret Thatcher, but Theresa May probably had more sympathy and, you know, fuck, wow.
One thing we haven't yet brought up is the IRA. This was back in the 80s, the era of the Brighton bombing and so forth. So what are your memories of Margaret Thatcher's handling of the IRA in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, my memory is my granddad at one of our family parties saying nobody'd ever forgive the IRA for missing.
For context, your grandfather was a member of the British Army in Northern Ireland.
He was a mouthy cunt. She effectively used Northern Ireland as a training ground for unpleasantness. It hadn't been a fucking picnic in the 70s either. It was absolutely poisonous, but she was not in any way interested in calming the waters. It suited her for there to be extreme circumstances because it meant that she got to implement extreme measures.
I appreciate that on the Tony Blair episode, you did a very good job of explaining why the Labour Party in opposition to Thatcher really weren't up to par. Can you just cover that briefly again here and just explain why somebody as awful as Thatcher was not easily removed by a Labour Party opposition.
My dad once commented that Labour only generally got elected when they had a leader who looked a bit Tory to sort of satisfy that Little England thing, alas. And so in the 80s, the Labour Party was initially run by the prototype Jeremy Corbyn, which was Michael Foote, who was a lovely, decent, thoughtful, empathetic human being who was an absolute fucking disaster as a political leader. Turning up at a war memorial in a parka or something like that is just like, no, the optics matter.
Being a nice guy in politics, that'll never catch on.
It will never catch on. And then he was replaced by Neil Kinnock. And Neil Kinnock was actually a really, really good orator, proper sort of firebrand Labour guy, but not too far to the left. But he was Welsh and ginger. I have to just tell everybody, I am married to a Welshman with a lot of ginger in his beard. The fact that being Welsh and ginger was considered problematic is something that enrages me to a degree that I cannot express. I mean, there's problems with Neil Kinnock, there's problems with every politician, but the perceived problems with him were those, and the shallowness of that enrages me.
At least they knew how to eat a bacon sandwich, though, so he had that going for him.
Thing is, you know, Ed Miliband's one of those people you think, again, not a bad human being, but just a complete fucking disaster as a person at the helm.
It's kind of interesting that now I think Labour are having this problem where they're struggling to really connect to the English working class. That seems to be what they're saying is their difficulty. And they've tried to deal with that by just becoming very nationalistic, it seems, in some ways. The flag waving crap, which I don't know. I mean, it might work in some ways for them. Maybe that is a technique that'll work. Not that I think they should do that, because I'm completely against that. But I don't know. It doesn't seem to have been effective so far, at least. But talking about Thatcher, I think it's quite interesting because, I mean, to get that victory early on in 79, she must have had to have tapped into something in, you know, working class Britain. You see, like, the places that she took in that election, even across the North England, you know, a few in Scotland as well.
Maybe I need to clarify this. My understanding as of right now is that prior to marrying Dennis, because he really had all the money, he was Mr. Royal, she did come from a relatively normal background, because that's certainly what the Tories like to talk about, young, hardworking Margaret in her father's shop in the local town type stuff.
No. I remember my dad explaining this to me, because you wouldn't think of somebody owning the local shop these days as being Mr. Moneybags, but my dad, one of nine kids, guess who's the Catholic, perpetually poor, useless dad, having to fucking grab his dad as he comes out of work on a Friday to get money off him before he goes to the pub and pisses it all up against the wall to make sure the fucking kids are fed, that kind of shit, you know, straight out of Andy Cap. And the local shop owner in their street would give tick up to a certain amount. Everybody owed him. It was almost like, you know, loan sharking. The local shop owner was an enormously powerful and well-resourced person, usually. My dad said he remembers the guy that ran the shop in their wee bit. They were the first person to have a car, the first family to have a TV, that sort of thing. So she would have lived somewhere, probably, that had poverty, but she would not have experienced it personally.
So the presentation of young working class Margaret working in the shop, we working class Maggie, is a complete Tory fan fiction fabrication bullshit exercise, correct?
It's marketing, isn't it?
It is.
I think part of the thing that they did tap into was, you know, if you were going to go down the Tory route, they would say that they are believing a meritocracy, and that regardless of where you are in society, their policies would give you the possibility of becoming whatever you want, you know, being successful. And a lot of people might have seen that and believed it. And in comparison to Labour Party, who their marketing is more like, we will help you to survive.
Come with us if you want to live.
Yeah. We'll give you an extra couple of quid so that you won't die of starvation. That's kind of like what the marketing seems to be from the left. And a lot of the time, there's not the kind of aspirational stuff where you can have a Lambo, you know. Whereas, you know, and it may be completely unrealistic for most people who are working class to aspire to great wealth or whatever. But that is a quite a strong motivational thing for you to want to follow them. So I think a lot of people don't really understand why working class people would support the Tories, but I think it is partly that, like, attitude of being who you want to be and being able to achieve everything, whereas it's kind of depressing, the whole, like, oh yeah, you just make you surviving benefits for the rest of your life.
It's a sort of version of the American dream, isn't it? This idea that anybody can succeed. But the truth of the matter is that if you want to provide opportunity, you have to provide education and you have to provide opportunities for people. And you do that with redistributive policies and with a good education system. And Margaret Thatcher wasn't interested in any of those things. She was just interested essentially in self-promotion. So meritocracies can only work if there are actual genuine opportunities for people to succeed, which the more you start to charge for university, remove health services and things like that, the more impossible you make it for anybody to escape from poverty.
We have done episodes recently on Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage, Dominic Cummings, Alex Salmond, Donald Trump and Tony Blair. And probably by me reading out that list, you can tell that if you get an episode all to yourself, you must be a right prick. Where do you think Margaret Thatcher ranks amid that list?
Well, out of that lot, there's only one that's really got an ism, which is Thatcher. So in terms of the broader effect she's had on society and politics in general, I'd say probably she's been the most profound out of all of them.
Looking at that list, and maybe put Trump to one side because he's the American, but everybody else involved, it's almost like she's the origin point of this shit.
Yeah, and I think the reason is because what she was interested in doing was taking advantage of crisis to further an agenda, and that wasn't something that had been done so cynically before. I always recommend it. It's a really, really tough read, but I always do recommend that everybody should read The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, because when you read it, you then go, ah, right, now I understand Brexit, and now I understand Thatcher, and now I understand Reagan, and now I understand Farage and all these things, because it's this idea that if you can destabilize a system, you can take advantage of the moment after to remake the world and the political norms the way you want them to be.
As a wise man once said, where there is chaos, there is opportunity.
Where there's chaos, GR, there is opportunity.
Absolutely. And she was the birthing of that into the political waters of the UK. And the advantage that was taken of a moment of emergency. And Brexit was an emergency that they made happen. And COVID was an emergency that they just took advantage of. But in both instances, it's all been about moving power and money from us to them and their friends.
I would say there's definitely ways of being economically liberal and being more right-wing and not being an arsehole.
Yeah. And,
well, at least I hope there is, because that's where I'm coming from. My attitude has always been that you should try and reduce benefits from the top down and taxes from the bottom up. And the Conservatives have always done it the complete opposite direction.
Good evening. Mrs. Thatcher, who's led the country longer than any Prime Minister this century, will move out of Downing Street next week. She announced her resignation this morning in the interests of party unity.
So, Margaret Thatcher resigned. What are your memories of her resignation?
I found out I was walking down the stairs at school towards the lunch hall. For context, I went to quite a posh school, but I wasn't posh. And I was known to be antithetical towards the posh amongst my schoolmates. And so one of my pals ran up to me, seeing me. They were saying, Thatcher's resigned! And I remember thinking, might have chips for lunch. Celebrate. It was a kind of ding-dong, the witch is dead moment.
All the comedians and stuff had a great time slagging off Thatcher, spin image stuff, all that. Comedy had changed quite a lot over that period as well, so you had all these new comedians that come along and changed that whole scene, and it was a lot more political as well. Political comedy grew at that time, satire. It's a big deal, so all I knew really about politics was from watching like comedy stuff on telly.
I mean, Spitting Image used to be absolutely brilliant. They used to have this ability to get to the absolute heart of the problem with a character, and it was vicious. I mean, it was savage. The famous one is her in the cabinet are in a restaurant and she orders a steak and the waiter says, "What about the vegetables?" And she says, "They'll have what I'm having."
Oh yeah, I think one of my favourite recurring gags in the original Spitting Image was that Adolf Hitler was Margaret Thatcher's neighbour. So they had this sort of Wilson and Home Improvement type relationship.
This is my promise
okay.
to the people of the Video Podcast Network world. I will not eat a single morsel of food until Margaret Thatcher is dead and buried.
She died 3 weeks ago.
When Thatcher died, I was in Belgium making a toasty.
I'll give her a state funeral because a lot of people will want to pay their last respects and a lot more people will want proof that she is really dead.
And I was in Belgium on holiday making her a toasty in an Airbnb and my husband popped downstairs to say, "Thatcher's dead!" and nearly burnt the toasty.
Thatcher's dead thanks to 600 bits, mate. He's a honk. Honk for Thatcher's dead. Honk of Thatcher's dead. Honk if Thatcher's dead. Let's zoom in, everybody, for the big moment. We're going to find out. Is Thatcher dead? Let's find out. Honk if Thatcher's dead. Let's find out. That's a yes.
It'll be the first time that the 21-gun salute shoots the coffin.
Do you think she did any good?
Not a bit of good. Not a bit. I put a stake through her heart and garlic around her neck to make sure she never come back.
Isn't that a pretty horrible thing to say when her funeral's going on right now?
Too bad, too bad.
How much do you think it's going to cost?
3 million.
3 million.
3 million.
For 3 million, they could give everyone in Scotland a shovel and we would dig a hole so deep that we could hand it over to Satan personally.
I turn up at a friend's house and, mate, Thatcher's dead. And then someone says, "Shall we go to George Square?" Yeah, why not? Good times all round, there was music on. But you know, you went to the Scotia, they're giving you sandwiches. A real upbeat atmosphere, totally inappropriate for someone's death, but given who that someone was and who they affected, you know, just there was a good feeling there. You know, as if like some sort of ghost had been banished, you know, to some other world or something like that. But yeah, just the whole atmosphere, genuinely one of the best days of my life. And this is without, you know, this is without me having any real attachment to it. But with this, just to see what it meant to other people, to be out dancing in the street, singing along to all these upbeat, cheery songs, you know, "Celebrate good times, come on." It was a wonder to see. 8th of April, 2013.
What a day. I remember you texting me, going like, "I wish you were here. This is fucking amazing. I'm having the best time ever."
Yeah.
Goodbye, Thatcher. Yeah.